A notorious drug lord once wanted Anthony Bourdain to write his life story. The chef refused, not because the offer wasn't lucrative or fascinating, but because he understood that some stories shouldn't be told, at least not in ways that might glorify the teller. Yet these are precisely the stories we need to hear, not to celebrate the criminals, but to understand the uncomfortable truth. The most dangerous people often look remarkably ordinary. They have families who love them, talents that impress us, and justifications that almost make sense until you remember the bodies. This tension between the human and the monstrous sits at the heart of understanding crime, and it's where we must begin if we want to grasp how ordinary people cross extraordinary lines. In 1985, a 1787 Lafitte bottle etched with Thomas Jefferson's initials sold for $105,000 at Christie's. The story was irresistible. Discovered behind a bricked-up Parisian cellar wall, supposedly owned by America's third president. Billionaire Bill Koch later bought four similar bottles for $500,000, only to discover Jefferson's records mentioned no such wines, and he signed his name differently. The bottles traced back to Hardy Rodenstock, a flamboyant German collector famous for miraculous discoveries. Except Hardy Rodenstock was actually Meinhard Goerke, a former railway worker. His forgeries fooled experts. The wine itself predated nuclear testing, but modern tool marks on the bottles betrayed their recent creation. Rodenstock understood something profound. People weren't buying wine. They were buying connection to greatness. We desperately want certain stories to be true, willing to overlook inconsistencies when the narrative is compelling enough. Astrid Haleeder lives in hiding in Amsterdam, moving between safe houses in a bulletproof car. She testified against her brother, Willem Wim Haleeder, known as The Nose, a notorious Dutch criminal facing multiple murder charges. As his former legal advisor, she became the star witness against him. They grew up in Amsterdam's working-class Jordaan district under an alcoholic, abusive father. While Astrid studied law to escape, Wim descended into crime, orchestrating the 1983 kidnapping of Freddy Heineken. Despite her horror, family loyalty bound her. She even used her law degree to help him and accepted ransom money. After Wim orchestrated the murder of Cor van Hout, married to Astrid's sister Sonja, both sisters concluded their brother had become too dangerous. Astrid began secretly recording him, sewing microphones into her jacket collar. The recordings revealed a paranoid man who threatened to kill their children if imprisoned. When her cooperation became public, Astrid wrote a book called Judas, a title capturing her impossible position. She compared her decision to putting down a very sweet dog that bites children. Her story forces us to ask, what would we do if someone we loved become irredeemable? Ken Dornstein learned his brother David died on Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland in 1988. Among David's writings, Ken found eerie notes for the biographers, as if David sensed his life would be cut short. With only one Libyan operative convicted, then released after 8 years, Dornstein's frustration became obsession. When Libya's 2011 revolution created an opening, he transformed his home into an investigation center, tracking Abu Aguila Massoud, the bomb expert who traveled with the convicted operative. For Dornstein, vengeance meant delivering a message. On a day of your choosing, you put a bomb in an airplane. Now, on a day of my choosing, I will come to your home. Yet when he could finally confront Massoud, he chose instead to complete his documentary and return to his family. Sometimes reclaiming agency over your narrative matters more than confrontation itself. In December 2020, 32 years after Lockerbie, the U.S. charged Massoud, vindicating Dornstein's investigation. On February 12, 2010, Amy Bishop stood up during a faculty meeting at the University of Alabama in Huntsville, pulled out a 9mm Ruger, and methodically shot her colleagues, killing three. The Harvard-educated neurobiologist had snapped after being denied tenure. But the violence began 24 years earlier. Amy's brother Seth died from a shotgun blast she called accidental. She fled the scene armed, held mechanics at gunpoint demanding car keys, yet was released that evening with no charges filed. Amy received no counseling. Her father distrusted psychiatry, and the family left Seth's room intact. She returned to college, married, and had four children, including a son named Seth, born on what would have been her brother's 33rd birthday. Her volatility surfaced repeatedly, punching a woman at IHOP, shouting, "I am Dr. Amy Bishop." In 1993, pipe bombs were sent to her Harvard advisor. After the Alabama shootings, authorities reopened Seth's case. An officer confirmed he'd written murder on the charging sheet before being ordered to release her. Amy was indicted for first-degree murder. Amy claims no memory of either shooting, selective amnesia coinciding with her worst actions. One moment of violence can echo through decades when we refuse to acknowledge what really happened. Mark Burnett, a former British paratrooper turned TV producer, created Survivor and transformed American television. His most consequential creation was a president. Meeting Donald Trump at a 2002 Survivor finale led to The Apprentice, a show that made both men hundreds of millions while fundamentally reshaping Trump's public image. By 2003, Trump was a tabloid punchline whose businesses had foundered. The Apprentice mythologized him as an icon of American success through pure artifice. Reverent camera angles shooting from below, choreographed entrances with dramatic music, the menacing boardroom set. Trump's properties were constantly featured, transforming Donald into the authoritative Mr. Trump. Trump's presidency borrowed heavily from The Apprentice tropes. His campaign announcement featured him descending the gold escalator at Trump Tower, choreography repeatedly used on the show. A psychologist who consulted on the show notes that what made Trump magnetic as a reality TV star, the energy, the impulsiveness, the inability to articulate a complete thought, is precisely what captivated the world as president. We created a myth so compelling that it escaped the television screen and reshaped the world, and we couldn't stop watching. Judy Clark, America's premier death penalty lawyer, has never lost a client to execution. Defending Joe Kartsarnaev after the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing, she humanized him, using his nickname Jahar, and spending countless hours understanding his story. Her belief? People aren't born evil. Clark's methodology involves exhaustive investigation into clients' social histories. Her team portrayed Tsarnaev as a gentle teenager corrupted by his radicalized older brother, Tamerlan, emphasizing Chechen cultural expectations of younger brothers obeying older ones. In her closing argument, Clark mentioned Tamerlan over 100 times and appealed for mercy. Mercy is never earned, it's bestowed. After 14 hours, the jury returned a death sentence, one of Clark's rare defeats. At sentencing, Tsarnaev apologized. "I am sorry for the lives that I've taken, for the suffering that I've caused." Clark's work extracts a heavy toll. Most lawyers attempt one capital case and never return, but her real strength comes from asking uncomfortable questions. What does it mean to be human? Can we recognize humanity even in those who commit inhuman acts? These stories reveal how thin the line is between ordinary and monstrous. The rogues in these pages aren't cartoon villains, they're people who made choices. Evil doesn't announce itself with horns and a pitchfork, it shows up looking remarkably like us, which is precisely why these stories matter.